Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. The show's packed news stories, lessons, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. And to remind you guys, I am live Mondays at 1 p.m., every Monday at 1 p.m., so definitely keep tuning in. Today, we have news stories on a plant that has more foreign DNA than its own DNA, which is kind of mind-boggling, and I'm still trying to figure out how that works, but we'll get into that. And I'm also going to be talking about a DNA reading device that was developed that's 1,000 times smaller than the width of a single human hair. Another unbelievable story. We're talking genetics today. So how does this plant have more foreign DNA than its own? So this first news story is talking about this, and this plant called Ambriola is found only on this one island, Grand Terre, and it has multiple mitochondrial genomes worth of DNA. So it's not just its own mitochondria, it has a bunch of it. And it ends up adding up to be more than its own original DNA. And how this happened has caught the attention of scientists. And findings from research may provide insight on what junk or non-coding DNA is, this DNA that doesn't code for any proteins that right now we're not really sure exactly what it does. So where did this plant acquire this new foreign DNA? So the plant got it from a type of moss and three green algae plus several hundred miscellaneous genes from another algae and from an undetermined number of flowering plants. So it's really a mass of different types of organisms that it's taking this DNA from. Jeffrey Palmer commented on this, saying that the native genes are outnumbered by the foreign genes 6-1. So there's six times more foreign genes in this plant than its own genetics. And Jeffrey Palmer is a biologist at Indiana University Bloomington and corresponding author of the paper. And he reported these results in Science last December, Science the journal. And he also went on to say, nothing like this has ever been seen before. So that was utterly shocking. So a lot of these news stories I talk about sound like science fiction. And this one really, really is. It's like, how did this really happen? So to kind of look more into how this happened, Dan Sloan is a mitochondrial expert. And he commented on this study. And he said, quote, it adds a long list of amazing and downright strange things about plant mitochondrial genomes. And Dan Sloan is an assistant professor of biology at the Colorado State University who studies the evolution of mitochondrial DNA. So this is really what his career is focused on. And hearing that this is so strange and different for him to see, who is so ingrained and so, you know, immersed in mitochondrial genomes and looking at all of that, for him to say this is definitely a big deal. So what kind of plant is this? That's the real question. So Ambriola is an evergreen shrub with small white flowers that grows only on this one island, I said, Grand Terre in New Caledonia. And this is like over 1,000 kilometers off of the east of Australia, just to kind of give you a little idea of where it is. So how did scientists figure this out? How do you look at a plant and say, you know, I think there might be more genes in this than we think? So how did they know what mitochondrial DNA was in the Ambriola plant? So what they did is they sequenced the mitochondrial DNA of the Ambriola plant and found nearly a complete genome from moss mitochondrion. And this moss mitochondrial genome was broken up into four pieces throughout the DNA in the Ambriola plant. So we have the genome from the moss, the mitochondrial genome from the moss, was broken up into four pieces, and it's put throughout the Ambriola plant. Now, scientists found the same concept applied with three pieces of green algae. So this idea of having the genome from the mitochondrial genome from an organism coming into a different organism, and that genome is not just like staying together. It's being split and put in different parts and kind of just mixed all around in there. So they found that two extra sets of mitochondrial genes, and it seems like those sets are from parasitic flowering plants. And the surprising part is that all these genes seem to be non-functional, meaning they do not code for proteins or regulate which genes get expressed as proteins. And I mentioned this before, saying that this research may indicate what junk DNA is, and I put junk in quotes there because it's kind of hard to believe that we have DNA in there that does nothing. It must do something, and research is expanding upon this idea and really researching what the junk DNA does, and this is one of these news stories that is starting to get into that. Palmer commented again, saying, it's like Ambriola is a museum full of ancient DNA that is just decaying away. And the embryolic consumes the mitochondrial genomes. And scientists are guessing tens of millions of years ago this happened based on the accumulation of mutations. What's really cool about this, kind of a side note, is that you can look at DNA and see that it's how many years ago something diverged, like in evolution. You can say, oh, well, these two species must have diverged this many years ago because they have this many mutations different between the two. And there's like a little kind of equation or something you can relate to, that there's X number of mutations per million of years. And then you can say, all right, well, we have this many mutations, so it must have been this many million years ago. So that's probably how they did that. Now, this discovery was a giant leap in finding a plant that has consumed the most foreign mitochondrial DNA. The previous plant that held the title of consuming the most foreign DNA was Rafflesia, and it only contains 10 to 20 genes compared to the plant we've been talking about, Amberiola's collection of 197 foreign genes and four near complete foreign genomes. So we're going from the leader plant that had consumed the most foreign DNA being having only 10 to 20 genes kind of extra. Now compare this to 197 in this new plant, Amberiola. So this is huge. And Palmer and his colleagues proposed that when Amberiola and its epiphytes, which are plants that grow on other plants, were simultaneously wounded, mitochondria from the moss, which is lichen-derived algae and parasitic flowering plants, mixed and combined with the contents of the Amberiola cells that ultimately heal together. So they're kind of wounded, and then they kind of heal together and kind of mix their genes and everything. So because all plants share the same method of mitochondrial fusion, the mitochondria of these unrelated species then fuse with Amberiola's and swapped DNA. And earlier I mentioned this plant may lead to further insight on junk DNA, and the current information from this study could be interpreted as evidence that extra DNA is neutral force in evolution, which would support the long-standing thing that questioned by recent research from the ENCODE, which is the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements Consortium, that the vast majority of non-gene coding DNA in our own genome is also junk that serves no purpose but also carries little or no price. So this is really saying it's neutral and it's not really helping the organism, it's not helping the species evolve at all by adding this, having more of this junk DNA, that this DNA that we don't really know what it does. So that's kind of one argument on all of that. There's also a stance that plants have much extra DNA and are more stable and better at surviving because of it. Sloan, who I mentioned before, who's the mitochondrial expert, says, quote, maybe Amberiola is not so different. Maybe this actually happens a lot, the insertion of these large genomes into plant mitochondria. But because it's more stable in its evolution, we can actually observe it better and doesn't erase the footprints of those insertions as fast. And, end quote. So Sloan is suggesting that its genetic stability over 200 million years since it's split from the rest of the flowering plants, when their evolution kind of diverged into two different species. So when this split from the rest of the flowering plants, may have something to do with its reluctance to clean its mitochondrial closet. And so having maybe that this stance is kind of saying that maybe having more DNA makes it a little more stable and better at surviving, kind of gives it an advantage that way. So there's a lot of different stances. The first one I mentioned being that it's neutral, it's not really doing anything. And the one I just mentioned now is saying that, having extra DNA is really making it stable and better at surviving. So there's a lot of different kind of views going on, and not enough information to really say which it is. It really could be anything at this point. And it's just really interesting to hear that this is occurring and that plants are taking in other organisms' genomes and having more genes from other plants than their own, and kind of how that would affect the phenotype. This news story didn't really get into that, but I'm kind of wondering now, having all those genes, are they being expressed? It said that most of it was non-coding, but is all of it non-coding? Are the genes that was taken from these other organisms into the Amberiola plant, is the Amberiola plant showing any of these genes? Are they being expressed? Are they showing on the phenotype? Is it helping the Amberiola plant survive? Is it giving it an advantage? These are all things that we don't know. And that's kind of the exciting thing about science, is that we are consistently and always really working towards figuring all of this out and you know, genetics is always expanding and always growing and figuring out all of this stuff. So it's very, very exciting. Our next news story I mentioned before, a little teased, is that there's this tiny DNA reading device that was developed that is 1,000 times smaller than the width of a single human hair. If you like look at one of your hairs right now and see how the diameter is so small, imagine 1,000 times smaller than that. I mean, you probably wouldn't even be able to see it with the naked eye. You'd probably need a microscope to see it. So this device is sensitive enough to distinguish the individual chemical bases of DNA. Now, this is something that I remind you guys all the time, but the bases of DNA are adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine, represented by A, C, T, or G for short. So DNA is made up of these bases, and so by reading these bases, it's an indication of, you know, different genes and what that organism has or that species has in terms of their genetics. There's more than that. It's not just the bases they have. There's this thing called epigenetics that that show that it's not just the sequences of bases that someone has that shows phenotype. It's also epigenetics that it's controlling which of those are expressed. So this is kind of like the blueprints, but the blueprints are kind of controlled by these epigenetic changes, such as DNA methylation or histone proteins and acetylation of histone proteins, but I'm starting to probably get above your heads. But just so you know, it's not just the base sequence of things. There's also a lot of other things that go into expressing genes. It's not just, you know, what's written there kind of in our cells. But basically, this device is sensitive enough to read the individual bases. So if you kind of put the DNA through this device, it's able to read it because the different bases have the different chemical properties. So this device is able to really read it based on the different chemical properties of the bases. And basically, this happens when they're pumped past the reading head. And a team of scientists from Arizona State University Biodesign Institute and IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center had developed this prototype DNA reader that could make the whole genome profiling an everyday practice in medicine. And who knows, we could even have this technology available on our phone soon. My professor mentioned that at one point in lecture a couple weeks ago, that that our technology is advancing so fast that, you know, computers used to take up roomfuls, and now we have computers in our pockets. So it really goes to show that this technology could be available everywhere very soon. And the research team has developed a scalable manufacturing process to make a device that can work reliably for hours at a time, identifying each DNA chemical base while flowing through this 2-nanometer gap. So we're really getting to small, small little gaps here and really small devices. So the DNA is flowing through this 2-nanometer gap, which is like incredibly small. Stuart Lindsay, an ASU physics professor and director of Biodesign Center for Single Molecule Biophysics, commented on this, saying, "Our goal is to produce cheap, simple, and powerful DNA and protein diagnostic devices into every single doctor's office." So let's just take this in for a moment. If you go to your doctor's office, in his mind, every doctor's office out there is going to have this technology to be able to diagnostic devices of DNA and protein. So this is just awesome that if this happens, because it'd be a major, major advancement in personalized medicine. And if we can create a device that will sequence a genome for, say, less than $1,000, insurance agencies are more likely to start coverage or reimbursement for this and really help the patient say, "Oh, okay, we're going to help you out." And then patients are more likely to take advantage of these technologies and the information that can be derived from it. So patients could have their DNA analyzed to identify the best form of treatment for the condition right there in the doctor's office. They wouldn't need to seek out a plant, a place to sequence. And if it's under $1,000, it's more affordable, more realistic to have done. And if it's under $1,000, it's probably not going to take as long as it has in the past. And this number of sequencing DNA has rapidly declined, the cost of it. I believe I've said this on the show before, but I believe it's like $100,000. It was like 14 years ago or something like that. And now it's like getting around $1,000. So it's crazy how much this has changed because the technology is evolving so fast. And also, if it's $1,000, again, insurance agencies would be able to help and say, oh, okay, like if it's only $1,000, like sure, we can cover some of that or all of that even. So this could really, really change things. And just imagine, you go to the doctor's office, you're not really sure what's up, you're like, oh, well, let's just sequence your genome. See if you have a gene for this. And if you do, then maybe we'll try this medication. If you don't have that kind of gene, if you have a different allele for that gene, let's try this medication. And instead of this guess and check of like throwing meds when someone has symptoms, you can have more educated on what that person really has to be able to target their medicine. That's what personalized medicine is all about. Seeing what that person has different than other people and kind of what category of people they're put in, what they're like, and saying this medication works for people in your category, people like you. And so, meaning people like you, like the genetics they have in this case. So this really, really could change things, and it's very exciting to hear about. And what's even more exciting is that this technology has been proven to be more efficient and accurate than today's state-of-the-art so-called next-generation DNA sequencing technology. So there's these new ways of sequencing DNA so much in the past, like, 20, 30 years that, like, you know, we had Sanger's ability to he came up with this this process of sequencing DNA that you put these how DNA replicates is each base pair comes in one at a time and kind of starts adding to make a template DNA strand from the original. And so what he figured out is if we put a certain type, if we put one of the nucleotides, one of the base pairs, the A, T, C, and G, if we put one of those in that doesn't allow for any more to add on, then it will stop and we can see, okay, this has this much. And whenever they stop, you can start reading from there what the sequence is. And so you can start sequencing from there. Now, this takes a long time compared to the technology we have today, but that's kind of how DNA sequencing started with Sanger's technique. And now we're at this thing where something is, you know, less diameter than a piece of your hair and it can sequence DNA. So it's just really rapidly evolving. Lindsay also said, quote, the technology we've developed might just be the first big step in building a single molecule sequencing device based on ordinary computer chip technology. Previous attempts to make tunnel junctions for reading DNA had one electrode facing another across a small gap between electrodes, and the gaps had to be adjusted by hand. So by hand, that's important. This made it impossible to use computer chip manufacturing methods to make devices. He goes on to say, our approach to defining the gap using a thin layer of dielectric insulating material between the electrodes and exposing this gap by drilling a hole through the layers is much easier. So he's really going towards the ability to use computer power and computer chip technology to be sequencing this DNA instead of doing things by hand, because obviously computers are going to be much faster than humans. And his last quote here is, what is more, the recognition tunneling technology we have developed allows us to make a relatively large gap of 2 nanometers compared to the much smaller gaps required for previously for tunneled current readout, which were less than a single nanometer wide. And the ability to use larger gaps for tunneling makes the manufacture of the device much easier and gives DNA molecules room to pass through the electrodes. So, end quote. And you can just imagine that if DNA is going through this electrode thing and sequencing, being sequenced through this passage, that if it's really small, the DNA is going to have a harder time. If you're putting something through a small hole, it's going to take longer. But if you are putting the DNA through a bigger hole, then it's going to kind of slide through a little bit easier. So that's definitely going to help the efficiency and probably accuracy, I would imagine, because this is more accurate than the state-of-the-art so-called next-generation DNA sequencing technology. And because of this, this could be the next big thing, that this is what this is going to be the next kind of standard for having DNA diagnosed, you know, a sequence, and then, you know, we can look at diagnostic tests from that. And I think this is why the field of genetics is so important, especially in medicine, because we're really getting down to that personalized level of seeing what people have and what medication would be best for them. And having that personalized is just going to make medicine so much more efficient and better, and probably have so many more success stories for, you know, diseases that maybe previously were incurable or the treatment wasn't that great for it, or whatever it may be, that we really see a great advancement in all of this. And that's why, you know, this is so important. And once we sequence the DNA, you need someone to be able to analyze it and really be that kind of middleman between the information that the patient gets and having the patient understand what that means. And I've talked previously on the show about like genetic counselors and the importance of them. And this is kind of fits right in nicely with the story that genetic counselors are so important because, or doctors that are able to really that understand this and can explain this to patients, anyone that can fulfill that role, that they are able to explain to the patients what all this means, because you can't just get a printout of your DNA sequence and then be like, oh, okay, I'll just read through this. Like, it doesn't really work like that. You need someone trained that can really understand things and be able to pick important information out of it. So very exciting stuff. Our next news story is that coffee might help you through the day, but it doesn't have the same effect on an embryo. There's been various studies that show the effects of caffeine and nicotine exposure in utero on DNA, and it's specifically altering DNA methylation. This is something I mentioned before. DNA methylation is an epigenetic feature, and it kind of controls what genes are being expressed. And if something is generally, there are exceptions, but generally, if DNA is methylated, it's not going to be expressed. So if there are certain genes that are methylated, meaning that they have a methyl group attached to those base pairs, then they're not going to be expressed, and that that protein will not be made from it. So this coffee and caffeine in utero of these embryos also is altering gene expression, obviously, because that's coming from DNA methylation, but gene expression and cardiac function for the long term are seen in fully grown and prenatally exposed adults, exposed to caffeine, that is. So there's a recent study that provides further information on the effects of caffeine. That's kind of what we knew so far, but this study really expands our knowledge on this topic. And it's expanding our knowledge on the effects of caffeine on the cardiac cell line of an embryo. So here's what they discovered. It's kind of four main points here. After 48 hours bender, there's an altered expression of the structural and hormonal genes and cardiac transcription factors and miRNA, microRNA. And so it's caffeine is changing the structure and hormonal genes, certain transcription factors for cardiac cells, and microRNA. So it's affecting all of these things. Another point is that the exon usage was also affected with nearly 600 exons. And exons are protein coding sequences of DNA. And these are changed in response to prenatal caffeine exposure, that these exons that eventually are expressed as proteins and proteins are made, they're affected by this. And news story didn't really go into how it was affected. Maybe we don't know. We just know that they're affected. But usually if they're affected, I would assume that this would be a negative consequence. The third point is that RNA sequencing of their rodent model also showed changes in genes controlling DNA methylation and histone modifications. These are really, I can't stress enough, these are all epigenetic changes happening here. We got DNA methylation, histone modifications, and these can have major effects on what's being expressed. The fourth point, there's a global decrease of DNA methylation, meaning that more genes were being expressed. So embryos that were exposed to caffeine during development have a decrease of DNA methylation, meaning that more genes are being expressed. So it's really kind of a mixture of genes being expressed more, genes being expressed less, but it's depending on which genes we're talking about. But obviously, these are major factors that are really changing what the embryo would be if it wasn't exposed to caffeine during development. And the findings leave the team concluding that prenatal caffeine exposure gives the developing embryonic heart a bit of too much of a buzz. So this was kind of an interesting news story. I will post the link on the website. They were kind of witty and pointing things out and cool stuff like that. So that wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. You can tune in next week, Monday at 1 p.m. on WHUS.org or 91.7 FM to learn more about genetics. Again, Monday, 1 p.m. Listen in. But if you can, you can go to dnapodcast.com. I've got all the episodes on there, even episodes that have not been aired on WHUS. So you can check that out. There's lots of lessons and mini lessons. There's awesome resources on there. And definitely go check it out if you are interested and want to learn more, or you want to listen to an episode again, because sometimes I talk so fast on the show that I don't even realize it until I'm in post and listening to it and was like, wow, I need to take a breath once in a while. But you can also follow on Twitter at DNA Podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Kira Dineen, K-I-R-A-D-I-N-E-E-N. And if you have any questions you want answered on air, I love getting questions, emails, even if you're just like, hey, listen to the show. Thanks. I really like it. Or I hate your show. You should talk about this. I love getting emails. So definitely email in at info@dnapodcast.com. If all that information is too much for you, just remember dnapodcast.com. Everything's on there. It's all linked and all of that good stuff. So thanks for listening, and join me next week, Monday at 1 p.m., to learn and discover the new advances in the world of genetics.